Our guest this hour draws a straight line from public education to a functioning democracy and sees an effort to subvert both. Derek Black is the author of Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. Derek Black teaches constitutional law at the University of South Carolina Law School. He writes extensively on education law, has been cited in federal courts up to the Supreme Court, and is called upon to comment on education law frequently in the media. Derek Black, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jeffrey. This is book releases today and kicking it off with you, so really exciting to be here.
Oh, glad to have you on book release day. That's great. So, you know, the interesting pathway for you to get to where you are now. It's not like you were destined to go to college, for one, and major in African-American studies, for two. How end up there?
Yeah, I mean, as I tell in the book, it really is the sort of hard work and efforts of a lot of teachers who often wanted more for me than I wanted for myself. But also, and this is part of the story of the book, I say public education really is the inheritance that's passed on from generation to generation to kids who really can't expect a generation and could not expect a sort of inheritance in any traditional sense. And it is the gift. It is the gift that my community of Clinton, Tennessee gave me and people hundreds of years ago decided I needed. And so, you know, that sort of stability for a kid who didn't really have a lot else going for him, you know, helps sort of propel me to college and then on to working in D.C. and civil rights law and now a professor. But, you know, part of my history is also bound up in race. I am a white male from a predominantly white community, a small little community. But my high school, before I went there, but my high school was the first formerly white high school in the South to graduate an African American. So, you know, the experience of being in a community that had that deep history, I think, you know, sort of piqued my interest and my openness to thinking about issues of equality and race. So, you know, I owe my public education for teaching me the three R's and a lot more. And I also owe it for the experience of exposing me to sort of the benefits of diversity and a different, you know, sort of a different type of way forward than what we previously had in my community.
That's a great story you tell about that high school in Clinton, Tennessee, where the black high school was up the hill, and it wasn't just a high school, it was an everything school, and people in the community just said, you know what, let's just let them walk down the hill to the high school, and so that's what ended up happening. Give us a sense of where you see public education standing now, years after these efforts to equalize things.
Well, you know, I tell this sort of long story and about how education has always built this democracy up, that each time we needed to expand the ballot or access to democracy, that we did that through public education. There have been two times in history where people tried to pull public education back as a way of retracting democracy, and one of those was after Reconstruction during the redemption period, that when the segregationists went after African-American citizenship, they went after both voting and education, seeing how those things were interlocked. And then in the backlash to civil rights gains in the 60s, again, some of the southern states considered and made attempts to close public schools altogether, right, to sort of shut down that expansion of democracy. My fear is that we see that same thing happening again today. Now, no one is wearing hoods and no one is standing at the schoolhouse doors blocking them. What we have, however, is a full-scale assault on public schools as an institution trying to shrink their footprint and move money out of public schools and students out of public schools into private schools, which, you know, there's a lot good to be said about a lot of private schools out there, but, you know, they cannot serve all of our children, and the values that many of them pursue are not the same ones that we want our public schools to pursue.
Let's go with something really contemporary then. And your book is recent enough that it includes some references to education through the age of COVID. But then you've got this announcement by President Trump last week that he wants to get more of a patriotic curriculum in history in the schools and stop teaching about things like white supremacy and all the bad things that happened in America.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually working on a piece right now because, you know, this one piece is that I say, you know, President Trump is actually in no position to comment on the value of teaching our racial history. And I say that not in any pejorative sense, but I say it to contrast his educational experience with mine, which is, you know, a young man who got to go to a desegregated school, a young man who got to attend a school with an African American studies program and decided to major in it, that it really opened my eyes to the world and helped me love my country and understand my country in ways that I never could have understood it or appreciated it before. Not, you know, I don't appreciate America as some sort of cartoon that plays on Saturday mornings. You know, I appreciate it as a thorough documentary of our experience. And part of the beauty of America is that despite all of our failings and all of our flaws, we are built on a set of ideas and goals that has, number one, caused people to keep striving to reach them, right? So the beauty of America is that we never have given up on those ideas of equality and full access to democracy. We've never been perfect, and we're not perfect now. And that's what actually scares me about the assault on public schools today, is that instead of continuing to try to reach for a more perfect union, to try to reach for a more equal education system, that we have some that are just wanting to shut it down. And if we do that, America is going to move backwards. It is not going to move forward.
So you have to admit the flaws in addition to the greatness in order to be able to get a full picture and to get better.
Yeah, that's right.
So, Derek, let's start the history lesson here. The education in schools by those terms don't appear in the federal Constitution, but you've got a pretty good sense from reading the history what the early idea was among the people who started the country.
I point out in the book that public education and the idea of it actually precedes the Constitution itself. So before we had even fully declared independence, you have Jefferson and Adams writing about how important public education for the masses will be to our democracy. And then when we declare independence, you know, they are worried, right? Because when we get our independence, they say, look, this is a radical experiment. This world has never handed over the reins of power from monarchs and elites to regular folks. And if we're going to do that, we've got to educate those folks. We can't just turn it over without them having some understanding of the common good. And that's what they were really pursuing. So Adams and Jefferson really began working on this very early on. In fact, Adams, in the Massachusetts Constitution, which predates the United States Constitution and actually is a model for the United States Constitution, Adams obligates the state of Massachusetts to forever cherish and care for the public schools in Massachusetts, right? And so we had this idea from the get-go. And Thomas Jefferson is trying to achieve the same thing in Virginia. He's not as successful as Adams, in part because, you know, the war is going on around him there in Virginia. But what does happen in the years following the war is the Northwest Ordinance. Now, most people haven't heard of the Northwest Ordinance, but it was passed by the Continental Congress before we had a Constitution, that sort of period, you know, between Articles of Confederation and the U.S. Constitution. And the Northwest Ordinance is central to the passage of the Constitution. And the reason why is that all of the states, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Connecticut, they all had competing land claims to all of the Western territories. So everything outside of the colonies, you had three or four states claiming that they all owned it. So part of the deal of having a constitution is for those states to give up their claims to the Western territories, and then the Constitution would provide the mechanism for them to become states. Well, also in that Northwest Ordinance, it's basically a land map deal that says every single square inch of the rest of this country is going to be divided up into little squares, and those squares are going to be divided up into towns, and each town is going to be chopped up, and the center lot of every single town and the rest of the land outside of the original colonies will be reserved for public schools. It says that they are to forever cherish them, right? So you see that sort of idea from Adams making its way into the Northwest Ordinance. And the land deal part of it comes straight out of Jefferson's work. So from the very beginning, before we have a constitution, we have a system of land development that says there will be a public school in the center of every community in the United States of America. So that's the first big touching off point. I then sort of go through lots of details, but the next really big one is following the Civil War, where we had not fully established a public school system. We had had lots of voluntary efforts, but not all the constitutions obligated states to provide it. So So what Congress says to the Confederate states following the Civil War is that if you want to reenter this Union, you must rewrite your constitutions and you must provide for public education. And all of the Confederacy does that. They all adopt provisions that obligate them to provide public education. And after the Confederacy does it, the rest of the nation follows suit. So that by the 1870s, every state in the country, except for Connecticut, has an obligation to provide public education. And again, the reason why was obvious. We were welcoming in former slaves, people who'd been excluded and subjugated, into the democracy. And the idea is, look, if these folks are citizens, they have to get public education. Same ideas from the founding.
All right, so let's shift things around. We're talking to Derek Black here on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy, and talk about what's happening now. I mean, it's generally headlined under the idea of school reform, but you seem to discount the idea that this is just reform, and I'm going to put quotes around reform.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is an agenda first of all, I think you look at Betsy DeVos and the president, and they have started using the word government schools as a pejorative term, right? Who would go to a government school? And the very idea that you would denigrate and sort of make fun of the idea of a public school strikes me as very troubling. And the rest sort of follows.
Aside from the fact that they are public officials saying this.
Well, that's true. Yes, maybe we should be against government military too. I don't really understand their point. But yes, so they are attacking the idea. And trying to move enormous amounts of funds out of the public system into the private system. And, you know, Betsy has really been doing more, to be quite honest, on the state level over the past few years than the federal level. She's been going around working with governors, trying to get them to adopt new private voucher programs to take money out of public schools and put them into private. And Florida is the poster child for this. I mean, they were well on their way before Betsy DeVos came along. But, you know, Florida is spending almost $1 billion a year on private K through 12 education now, when they were only spending about 10 or 20 million a year a decade ago. So this has just been an astronomical increase, and Florida's not alone. So that's one thing. But, you know, COVID, I think, has really pulled back the veil on how much they hate the public schools and how committed they are to privatizing them. So, you know, Congress passes the CARES Act. We all know about that, sending out, you know, trillions of dollars all over the place. You know, there's a big, huge chunk of money in there for public schools. And I think Congress and most of us thought, okay, you know, Betsy DeVos, at least in a moment of national crisis, will put aside her partisan agenda and simply try to use this money to serve our children in schools, right? 90%+ of them enrolled in public schools. But what does she do? She immediately tries to find gray area to move that money out of the public schools into the private schools. And, you know, she's already lost three cases in the last 2 weeks for trying to do so. And so one of them, it was a Trump-appointed judge, said to Betsy DeVos, the law cannot mean the opposite of what it says. And I think that sort of sums it up, that they are so dead set on harming our public schools and promoting private schools that they will literally do things that are the opposite of what the law says.
Well, this is right in the federal eye, but there's lots of cases that you give at the state level, too. I mean, like in Kansas is an example you gave here, and Nevada as well. What
yeah.
kinds of things happen there?
Yeah, so, you know, Kansas is a perfect example where Brownback, during the recession, sort of becomes a governor there and is really promoting a lot of the ideology of Grover Norquist and others. And the sort of famous line there is they wanted to shrink government to the size that you could drown it in a bathtub. And so what he does is passes an enormous tax cut, right, in the middle of the recession and says, you know, this isn't going to have any effect on anything. This is going to jumpstart our economy if we do this. And then 2 years later, he goes, sorry, it didn't jumpstart the economy, but since we've cut taxes, we've got to find a place to take this money from. And so he begins taking it from the public schools, right? And it really was quite an obvious plan. You know, Alec, the Koch brothers, and all those folks had said, public education is the lowest hanging fruit in the nation. for our agenda. And so they began sort of making changes to the tax code and public school funding to shrink public education to the size that you can drown it in a bathtub. Nevada, rather than going after straight after public school budgets, did pass a voucher program that would have allowed every single student in the state, if they chose, to leave their public school and go to a private school and take all of the money out of the public school and move it to a private school. Fortunately, you know, the state constitutional right to education in Nevada was strong enough to block that, but it hasn't been sufficiently strong in some other states. So we see these enormous attempts to pass legislation that would basically loot the entirety of the public education kitty.
Derek Black is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor of constitutional law at the University of South Carolina Law School, writes extensively on education law, has been cited in federal courts up to the Supreme Court, comments frequently on education law in the media. Now he's talking about his own book released today called Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. You're welcome to join the conversation here on the Exchange. You might have some fairly strong feelings about public education, pro or con, or how it's being handled today and how it figures in the maintenance of democracy. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So just to get to the nub of the argument, then, vouchers and charters essentially take the students and the money away from the existing public schools.
That's right. And you know, the theory of the sort of market and economist is that the market will improve everything, and that if they're losing the students, they don't need as much money. Well, you know, think about anyone listening. Think about your child's own school, and let's assume that two or three children out of your child's public school decide to go to a private school, and let's say your state is spending $10,000 per pupil. So that's $20,000 or $30,000 out of each classroom, right? You know, multiply that by 20 classrooms; it starts to get really big. But your school is not going to hire any fewer teachers, because two or three out of a classroom left. They're not going to, well, right now that we're not in person, but for those schools that are in person, and when they go back, the electricity bill is not going to go down. The bus route is not going to shrink. None of these things are going to change. They are fixed costs, right? And so ultimately what schools are going to have is less money to do the same job, whereas the private system is going to be, you know, bringing in more and more funds. And so what you get is the compromising the ability of public schools to do their job. And we've seen this with charter schools in other jurisdictions, you know, in Newark, New Jersey, for instance, and also in some rural communities, where all you need is one charter to come in and take 10-15% of the student population, and it may literally compromise the school's fiscal stability. In Chester, Pennsylvania, for instance, they were on the verge of bankruptcy because they were sending, I think, like somewhere in excess of half of their annual budget each year to charter schools. Now, some of the costs in Chester had gone down, but they hadn't gone down that much. And so, you know, it really does jeopardize the ability of these schools to serve the children that remain, right?
And elsewhere in Pennsylvania, you cite in the book Erie, Pennsylvania, where the schools considered closing because the funding had dropped so low. Was that directly related to charters and vouchers?
Pennsylvania statewide has had enormous funding challenges over the last, since Ed Rendell left office, and even when he was in there, they've had a terrible funding formula. But they made enormous cuts to public education following the recession, and they did statewide begin heavily investing in charters and also cyber charters, and there was a lot of fraud issues that came up there. But yes, the sort of fiscal stability of the Erie School District kept shrinking and shrinking as the world around it changed, you know, financially. And at one point, they just said, you know, we think we may just close our doors and dissolve ourselves. And that means that everyone around us will have to absorb these kids. I mean, that is a scary moment, if you can imagine you're a parent there and the idea that your public school district might just vanish into thin air. And that's effectively what's happened in places like New Orleans, where there really aren't any public schools, traditional public schools anymore. It's entirely a charter school system.
Hmm. So let's talk about the South then, because I do remember the Virginia district that closed for 5 years rather than integrate in the 60s. Is there any protection for students who are stuck in a district that simply can't or won't function?
Yeah, I mean, well, so the Virginia issue that you mentioned in Prince Edward County during the early 70s, they didn't want to integrate, and the state of Virginia had passed a statute that said that you can just give everyone a voucher and close your public schools, and so that's what they did there. And of course, their motivation was to segregate the schools, and that was the result. You know, when we send kids into the private sector, they do lose all of their protections. They lose, you know, LGBTQ youth, the most sort of obvious ones, and particularly in a private system that's predominantly religious, they may not have the same options that other children do, or even if they do have them, they're not going to be treated equally within the schools. Various other issues of gender discrimination or gender roles, right, also sort of particularly harmful to boys and girls, regardless of which one it seems to me. ELL students, students with disabilities, these students don't have anti-discrimination protections in the private system. And so, yes, there is an enormous concerns there. And the flip side, which I think I heard in a little bit of your question, is what about kids who aren't being served in the public schools and they want to go somewhere else? I mean, I'm not sort of casting blame at any parent who feels that their public school isn't serving them. I mean, I say in the book, particularly talking about African American and Latino children, these are families who never in the history of the United States have experienced a school system that has fully met their needs. So I understand why they would be disenchanted and looking for other options. And I don't, you know, the difference is I lay fault with the state legislature for refusing to fund those schools, refusing to equalize those schools. And what the state legislature is saying is, since we won't do our job of providing you with a quality education, why don't you just take a little bit of money and go somewhere else? And that strikes me as the problem. It's not the family's fault that they're put in this situation. It's the state's fault for putting them in this situation.
There's an interesting assumption that I see in the whole voucher concept, which is that if your school is failing, here's a voucher, get out of it. But I assume there aren't enough vouchers for everybody to get out of that school, meaning some people will still be left behind. That child will be left behind in a failing school.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. It, you know, varies state by state. Some states have caps. In fact, most of them have caps right now. So what you really are doing is creaming off a portion of the population. And it's probably the portion of the population that's, yeah, you don't want to compare, you know, varying degrees of disadvantage, but maybe families that have less disadvantage, because to go to another school with a voucher, you've still got to have the means to get there and support the child there. So the voucher rarely, if ever, covers all of the requirements, and there's no bus rides and that sort of thing. So, you know, you cream off a portion of the sort of most active and engaged parents, and everyone else is left behind. So that is an enormous problem for those that can't get that option as well. Yeah,
you were talking about Pennsylvania having a particularly poor school funding formula. Is there any that makes particular sense to you? You mentioned Connecticut didn't have constitutional protections for public education at first. That's where I went to high school, and I remember the whole funding mechanism got tossed out in the Supreme Court there. So, any state that has a good funding mechanism for schools?
Well, just so we don't lump on Connecticut too much, the reason why Connecticut didn't have one, and it's sort of a historical oddity, is that their commitment was so old and sort of reached back to the colonial period that they just never got around to passing one. So to be fair,
I didn't feel singled out or anything.
But in terms of ones that have particularly strong ones, Minnesota has a strong funding formula. Not to say that it's perfect, but it's strong. And New Jersey has really always been the leader on this issue, and in part because, you know, advocates have gone to the Supreme Court 30-some-odd times to insist that the state live up to its constitutional duty in education. But what Newark does, for instance, is basically says whatever the suburbs are getting, then the inner-city deprived schools must get at least that amount, right? And that has served to keep them on pace there. You know, Minnesota has a pretty big bump for low-income students. I think they get another 30% funding there. So there are some states that are moving in the right direction, but unfortunately most are in the wrong direction.
I want to make it clear that this is not just a one-sided you beating up on the likes of Betsy DeVos, the education secretary now, and Donald Trump, the president who hired her, but you take up issue with the President Obama and his education secretary as well.
The that was a tough period. I actually was an expert witness in litigation against, Arne Duncan during his administration. And, without getting into the nuances of that litigation, the short story is that, you know, Arne Duncan was fully committed to the expansion of charter schools. Some of you may recall that when the Congress passed the big stimulus bill back in 08, there was this chunk of money reserved for education innovation. And Arne Duncan took it and created what he called the Race to the Top Fund. So he had all these states submitting applications for Race to the Top Fund. And, you know, he was very blunt and said that any state that limits the number of charter schools will jeopardize their ability to receive Race to the Top funds. And as a result of that statement, states like North Carolina, for instance, that had long limited the number of charter schools in the state, North Carolina had limited them to 100, which would have been one per county maximum. Once you took that lid off, they began growing exponentially in places like North Carolina. So one, you know, he takes the lid off of charter school growth. But I also criticize him for sort of forcing these untested teacher evaluation systems down schools' throats. That in the process of waiving the No Child Left Behind requirements, he said, well, I'll let you out of No Child Left Behind, but only if you do some other stuff for me. One of them was the Common Core curriculum, and actually I'm sort of agnostic. I know Common Core gets a lot of people worked up, but he said, you got to have Common Core. And he also said, you got to have these teacher evaluation systems that rate teachers based upon their students' test scores. Now, when he first said that on face value, I said, well, that makes sense, right? If the kids are, you know, doing well, then the teacher's doing well, and vice versa. But when you drill down into it, and think about it, it just doesn't make any sense. Now, you know, number one, you know, how well a kid does in English this year is related to how well they did last year, so that's one point. And the other one is, you know, how well they do in social studies is related to how well they're doing in English. You just can't separate out the effectiveness of a single teacher based upon a one-time standardized exam for one. So that's one big problem. And the other one is, as a lot of teachers and families out there will know, is we don't even teach or we don't even test a lot of our subjects each year. I'm not trying to get us to do more testing, but the point is, you know, how are you going to evaluate the effectiveness of a science teacher if they don't even test for science this year or last year? So it was really nonsensical on multiple levels, and the data showed this. You had teachers that would show up as ineffective one year and effective the next. And, you know, unless we think a good teacher turns into a bad one in 12 months, you know, that just can't make any sense either. I mean, the results were random, but Arne Duncan pushed us down that road, and here we are. And, you know, I think Arne Duncan is well-meaning. Don't get me wrong. You know, my testimony in that case was really saying that he lacked the authority to demand these things. I wasn't really getting into whether they were good ideas or bad ideas. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm not just picking on DeVos. I have had my tussles with Arne Duncan as well. And to be clear, I'm not, you know, I was in the Obama transition team, so I had every reason to be favorable towards, Arne Duncan. But, you know, I just try to call it like I see it, and that's how I saw it.
Yeah, this kind of stuff has stretched across my entire career. I was just remembering that Lamar Alexander, when he was the governor of Tennessee, and I worked at a TV station that covered parts of Tennessee, was talking about the master teacher program, so that goes back to the early 80s. And so we've been talking about this stuff pretty much consistently since that time, and certainly before, about things like measuring teacher quality. But then you get into the ways in which states are going after things like teachers' tenure and collective bargaining rights, and how extensive have those efforts been and how successful?
Yeah, I mean, it was a war on teachers. I mean, it was on the front of Time magazine, and they called it a war on teachers. And we saw that with the teacher evaluation systems. We saw that with the sort of demonization of teachers during the recession, that somehow or another our fiscal problem was their fault and their responsibility. And, you know, this sort of idea that we've got a lot of terrible teachers out there, and if we could just get rid of them, we could fix our budget and fix our education. So let's do away with tenure. Let's do away with all these things. I mean, teachers were being hit on every side. And at the same time, class size was escalating because of the funding cuts, right? There was less money, less teachers to be hired. So we lost like 200,000 or so teachers in the immediate years following the recession. So the pressure on our teachers was enormous. And guess what? When the economy came back, there was no one to hire. I mean, if people don't have to, you know, look any further than 2 years ago in the New York Times regularly reporting on schools who couldn't find warm bodies in to put for our students. Why? Because teachers had been demonized and attacked on so many fronts that young people simply stopped enrolling. I mean, enrollments in colleges of education dipped by 50% and 60%. And many places. And so there is no pipeline right now of new folks going into teaching. And that's a scary thing. You know, I talk about it in the book. Kansas was literally putting teacher advertisements on billboards.
Wow.
If we're trying to convince truck drivers to give up their day job and come teach our children, no offense to those individuals. Hopefully a lot of them are listening right now. But right, they're trained to do their job and do it well, and teachers are trained to do an entirely different job. And billboards on the interstate is not the way to revitalize our public education system.
So at the federal level, you note several changes proposed and enacted by Betsy DeVos as education secretary. But you also get into how the major tax package that passed during the Trump administration also changes things around.
Well, Jeff, you've done about three of these. I just want to acknowledge it. You know, you and your staff are excellent readers. I mean, these are really important details, and I appreciate it, because most of America sort of missed that in the tax package, and many readers would have skipped right by that. But when the massive tax cut was passed a couple of years ago, you know, Betsy had been pushing for a voucher system that would just take money straight out of public schools and give it to the privates, and Congress wasn't having it. But one of the things that they put into the tax bill was to allow the college savings accounts that people were sort of planning for the future, for folks to be able to use that for private education and to start making much larger annual donations into those tax college savings accounts and to pay with tuition every year. So now what you can do, and hey, if you're listening, you know, don't miss out, right? I mean, I'm not trying to vilify you. That's the law now. You can do it. But is to, instead of paying your tuition to the school, Put it in the 529 savings account, and then have the 529 savings account cut checks to your public to your private school. That now eliminates those from sort of tax coverage. The other thing they did at the very same time was to cap, this is also your tax bill, cap the amount of state and local taxes that you could claim on your itemized deductions. So, you know, folks went through that back in April. Your states that spend a lot of money on public schools also have the highest state and local taxes, right? Because that's where they're going. Well, what the new bill says is we're capping that at $10,000. So if you're in a state that spends your sort of total allotment, right, it goes above that, then you're not getting a deduction for those additional state and local taxes, which is to say, if you send your kids to private school, you can get a complete tax deduction for all those expenditures, but we are going to limit the amount of tax deductions you will receive for paying into a system that supports your public school. So it really inverted the tax system on public and private education.
Yeah, I find myself wondering, Derek, if it's a situation like often happens with Congress, where, you know, people just have really, really low feelings about members of Congress, but so many of the incumbents get reelected. Do people walk around with this attitude that public education is not good and slipping, but my school's great?
Well, there is a lot of that. I will say, when it comes to Congress, and I've got a piece, a different piece, hopefully coming out in a few days, that says, you know, President Trump has and Betsy DeVos have put public education on the presidential ballot for the first time in 50 years. And I say that because when it gets to November, going all the way back to Nixon's the last exception, that pretty much the candidates are in the same place, right? They don't, you know, maybe they have a little sort of different nuance, but education is always bipartisan. I mean, even look at Congress. 90% of Congress voted for the Every Student Succeeds Act, you know, at the end of Obama's term, so that's Republicans and Democrats. And during George Bush's term, 90% of Congress voted for the No Child Left Behind Act. I mean, education is not a divisive issue. It doesn't mean we get it right, but at least we all agree to go in the wrong direction. We're not at each other trying to sort of kill public education. But this year, for the first time since Nixon tried to stop school desegregation and make that a presidential issue, for the first time this year, we have two people running for president that see the world entirely different. You know, and I'm not telling you who to vote for. I'm just giving you the facts, which is Joe Biden says he wants to triple funding for low-income schools, which is the main thing that the federal government funds. He wants to do some stuff for teachers, and I'm not pumping him. That's like plain vanilla stuff. Like, you normally hear that out of both candidates. President Trump says not one single word about improving our public schools, not one single word about putting any funds into our public schools, but rather says he wants to create school choice for every child in the country, right, to sort of move us away from public schools. And the second plank is the sort of racial history thing that you talked about earlier, so that, you know, private school choice for every kid in the nation, and for those who stay in public school, we want to make sure they're not teaching you about racial history. That's his public that is his education platform. It's not even a public education platform, though.
You mentioned some of the forces that are arrayed to make the changes in public schools. ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the Koch brothers. These are fairly frequent whipping boys for people on the left in America. Are forces, well-financed forces, are arrayed in favor of keeping or beefing up the support for education?
Well, I mean, look, we have, if the answer is there widespread support for beefing it up, the answer is easily yes. I mean, there was polls, and I talk about them in the book, that are bipartisan, that actually, if you look at Democratic and Republican voters, there's only a couple of percentage points that separates them on views regarding our need to fairly fund public schools, right? That they're both in the 80s, mid-80s, across the board. There was a poll I just saw this morning that was just looking at Republicans that found these sort of overwhelming sort of support for improving our public schools. Our teacher unions hold those same positions, but I don't think of them as a fringe element or sort of pursuing a narrow partisan end. They are pursuing the same goal that, you know, 80% of America pursues, and it's really this sort of extremely wealthy, hyper-partisan slice of America that's sucking enormous air out of the conversation to move things in the other direction. And that's the other thing, right, that we should be afraid of on any issue. When some small group of, you know, 5-10% of the country decides that they want the rest of us to do something entirely different that may even be against our own interest, we should be highly suspicious of that.
So how have lawsuits done to try to make sure that public education is preserved and is, in fact, public? Because, you know, I mentioned the lawsuit in Connecticut, I think, when I was still in school there, that said that the funding model was busted. But it never seems to make lasting change when things are taken to court.
Yeah, I mean, I'll confess on that one that it's sort of, you know, sometimes it's one step forward, two steps back, and sometimes it's two steps forward and just one back. But I mean, you know, it's this sort of perpetual challenge of, you know, a Supreme Court saying, you know, legislature, you're not living up to your responsibilities, forcing them to do better for a few years. And courts, you know, they take cases and controversies as they come to them. They are not sort of oversight legislative bodies. And so, you know, you have these states that perpetually slip back into bad habits. And part of that is, you know, it goes back to the electioneering and money aspect. You know, it's like, there's always someone running on the platform of, you know, our schools cost too much and money's away, you know, and the money spent on them is a waste, or your taxes is too high. And when they get to be governor or they get to be Speaker of the House, they don't care what the Constitution says. And that's what's troubling, which is goes back to this inheritance piece that I mentioned at the outset, that, you know, 150 and 200 years ago, you know, folks that had, I think, you know, tremendous wisdom and foresight said, if this nation is going to work for everyone, we got to have public education. They put it in the Constitution for it to be there for me 150 years later. Because if we let these things change based upon the vacillations of who wins an election, they're going to be looking out for how to win elections and how to serve themselves rather than serving generations of people long after they're gone. So it is a perpetual challenge, as you say.
Yeah, it is a fascinating study. I mean, we haven't even really gotten that deep into the history of it. The history section of the book is quite long and includes Charles Sumner and his efforts to make sure that education was fair in the Reconstruction South. That's a whole separate part of the book we didn't get to. Lots to talk about with Derek Black, the author of Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, take care.